September is a beautiful time in the Badlands of North Dakota. Every September, the nearby Theodore Roosevelt Center at Dickinson State University hosts a symposium focused on the life and legacy of our North Dakota Badlands Cowboy President. This year, DSU's TR Symposium will be held virtually online September 17th through 19th. The theme, Allies in the Arena, Theodore Roosevelt Circle, will explore the friendships that helped TR lead the country during the first decade of the 20th century. Scholars and authors like Clay Jenkinson, Patricia O'Toole, Deborah Davis, and Matthew Hoyos will explore TR's relationships with people like Booker T. Washington, Leonard Wood, and so many more. Theodore Roosevelt, the young cattle rancher, visited Dickinson twice in 1886. In late March, Redhead Mike Finnegan and two dim-witted cohorts stole TR's boat from his Elkhorn Ranch, intending to escape in that boat downstream on the Little Missouri River. TR's compatriots, Bill Sewell and Will Dow, built another boat, with which the three men pursued and captured the boat thieves west of the Killdeer Mountains. Sending Sewell and Dow, each man with a boat, downstream to Mandan, TR procured a wagon and driver for the thieves while he marched 50 miles across the frozen tundra, turning his prisoners into the sheriff's office upon his arrival in the Queen City. In July of 86, 27-year-old Roosevelt returned to Dickinson as the featured speaker for the Independence Day celebration. This September, in the cause of uplifting the legacy of Theodore Roosevelt in the Badlands, we give thanks for the good people of Dickinson and Dickinson State University, our allies in the arena. And now, the Great American Folk Show, a little place on the radio where we commune with you to share stories, sing songs, and talk to some good people with great voices. Stay with us over the next hour as we bring you visual artist, composer, and singer David Garza, North Dakota Associate Poet Laureate Bonnie Larson Steiger, banjoist, singer, gene maker, and founding member of Old Crow Medicine Show, Willie Watson, singer, songwriter, and multi-instrumentalist Tomo Nakayama. I'm Joe Wiegand. Good to have you with us on Prairie Public. Here's your host, Tom Brousseau.
Our first guest is an award-winning poet. Her work has been featured in publications such as Evening Street Press, Plain Songs Poetry Magazine, and North Dakota Quarterly. North Dakota State University Press published her chapbook, Destiny Manifested, in 2018, a collection that displays a remarkable range, at times imbued with a lovely poetic lyricism, while at other times grabbing us by the throat with raw and rugged realism. That sentiment expressed by Catherine Marenghi, a reviewer on Amazon. And so we begin with North Dakota Associate Poet Laureate, Bonnie Larson Steiger.
I'm reading two poems today. The Rabbit. Taking down the last frost-bitten ferns, the backyard scattered with crisp leaves, painted in hues of jewels blown about by the season's breezes, I found a rabbit, the one who nibbled off tender vines back in June, and I've kept a jaundiced eye on each day as I coaxed my clematis back up the trellis. This one and its littermates emerged last May from a nest in the iris patch. Wishing I hadn't forgotten to eliminate the whole lot with my trusty 22. Quick, clean, and painless. I filled the bird bath in the frosty dawn, half awake to something among leaves, blustered in the yard, but my first cup of coffee was calling from the kitchen counter. Later, in the glorious warmth of an apple cider afternoon, there it was again, the young cottontail, this time on its side, a skyward eye open and glazed. I came closer. Sensing danger, it pushed a limp foot in some primordial attempt to flee. But its body could not connect to nature's alarm. In that moment, fleas and ants scouted the furry rise and fall of its chest, another world between life and death. I have an obligation. I can't let it suffer. Damn that ethical code of the prairies. This could be worse. This could be my beloved but badly injured horse, or my failing old dog. No, it's a rabbit. Not just any rabbit, mind you, that clematis-eating varmint. How far have we come from our prairie ancestors? Has a manicured suburban life insulated us, absolved us from nature's grit? Who are we to rewrite the rules? Just stop. Trying to gather both courage and resolve, I let my mind race to buy time. What fate has happened to this creature? How long had it been there? Never mind, was it in pain? My stomach rose in my throat at its suffering. Buck up, woman. God help me do this. A mind-numbed walk to the shed with a spade. With pulse pounding in my ears and a familiar nausea not far behind, I took aim at the rabbit's neck. Grasslands. Let it be about farmed fields, corn tall and wheat flaxen, the edges of town fenced, planted into mowed lawns. Sometimes it's about the plains, great plains and high plains, vast virgin prairies and short grass prairies, grasses for grazing. You know it all, the whistle of wind through seed heads, a whiff of sage in the air from nowhere. Sometimes it's a deep tangle of roots far below ground, or a thatch of sturdy stalks crisp underfoot, revealing what you didn't see yesterday. Then let it be about grasslands, unfenced, wide as the dome of sky, corralled by earth's curving. Then we see everything and nothing.
I remember seeing Willie Watson on stage for the first time in the early 2000s. He was singing a song with a clever lyric. It took me by surprise. As soon as I heard it, it made me smile. The song, The Greatest Hustler of All, one that he co-wrote with fellow Old Crow Medicine Show bandmate Ketch Seeker, would later appear on the album Tennessee Pusher in 2008. I'm not going to sing it. I'll just recite that line now. Well, I took her to the fair on Friday. We stepped into the kissing booth. When I puckered my lips to steal me a kiss, she went and stole my gold tooth. Now, how many times has that line popped into my head? I don't know, but I bet at least 100 every year. Willie Watson is a songwriter, banjo player, guitarist and fiddler, and a fashion designer. For the past few years, he's been manufacturing denim goods at Willie Watson Manufacturing Company. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Willie Watson.
$1.50 at the Birmingham Mill for $1.50 times 3. She see the spinning wheels turn. She is young, but she'll learn with her slender white hands to weave. Twelve smokestacks in a row, 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 and a grill of five times three. See the mill boss patrol, hear the factory bells toll, and the girls look as sad as can be. Then she cried for her home country.
I moved to the South when I was 19 years old. I played in a band called the Old Crow Medicine Show, and we decided we would move down to North Carolina and settle on a long, winding dirt road, Flat Springs Road, on the backside of Beach Mountain. We played old-time string band music, and we wanted to immerse ourselves in that culture. We wanted to be where that music came from. And not just the old-time string band music, but we loved all the music from the South. The blues, the jug band music, the country and western, the swing, the folk songs. So there we found ourselves in a little old farmhouse way up on the top of Flat Springs Road. We had a tobacco field in our backyard. It wasn't our tobacco field. I believe it belonged to Alan Harmon. But we did work it. We picked it. We transported it. We hung it in a barn, and we might have even grated it. We made corn liquor. We made it on our kitchen stove. We made banjos. We hung out with Jack Guy and Jack Guy's shop. We made folk toys, whimsy diddles and flipper dingers, and bull roarers, and little birdhouses made of mountain laurel. Jack Guy, he was a rather famous man on the mountain. He was on the Johnny Carson show in the 1960s for selling folk toys. But what we were really there for was the music. Now, you have to understand that about 98% of the music that I listen to and love and play, it all comes from the South. And just about everything that's come after that, and all the music that people in America listen to today, it still has its roots in the South. The blues turned into rhythm and blues turned into rock and roll with a little bit of gospel mixed in there, and that turned into pop. And the mountain musicians who played the fiddles and the banjos, they went to New York City and they made records for Columbia, and they stamped hillbilly on the record. Country music wasn't called country yet, and it was stamped on the record as a genre. The blues records, they stamped race. They were called race records. Race records and hillbilly records. Black and white. But then anyway, the mountain music turned into bluegrass, and that turned into country, and country and western swing, and then on to the modern country music we have now, the country pop. And in between, we have folk rock and folk pop. But it all comes from down there in the South. So that's what we were doing there. We were there for the music. We took pilgrimages up the long, windy dirt roads in search of old mountain men and mountain women that might still play their washtub bass, or might still play their coffee can banjo, or might know a song that never was on any record. We did meet a lot of talented musicians, and I'll never forget this one in particular. We were at the Mount Airy Fiddle Festival, and we met up with this fella, and we played music with him there for a few days. We all had a real good time, and we thought it might be a good idea if he came and visited with us on the mountain for just a little while. Now, this fellow was one of the most southern guys I'd ever seen. Every word had 3 extra syllables. And he always wore his overalls, and he played good old southern music. And at first, he was very charming. And we invited him to come and stay for 2 weeks. We said, we have a show in Banner Elk at a coffee shop. You could play the show with us, and let's just go and have a good time for a little while. Well, those 2 weeks came and went, and he never left. Now, it became apparent very early on that he might want to tell a few jokes that we didn't think were very appropriate. And in the very beginning, you could say it was tolerated. And he'd have one of these inappropriate jokes to crack while we were trying to play music. Now, we'd play some of this mountain music with fiddles and banjos, and he'd be all for it. But maybe one of us wanted to play a blues song or a jug band song. And he might just get up and leave the room and say something under his breath about how he didn't want any part of that. But time went on, and it became a little bit unbearable. And I thought, man, when is this guy going to leave? And after a few more months, we found ourselves moving to Nashville, Tennessee. And I thought, oh, thank God, we're going to move to Nashville, and this guy's going to just stay here on the mountain. Well, that wasn't the case. He came to Nashville with us, and we all settled into a big house on the end of Dickerson Pike, and he lived in the little back room there. And by this time, I couldn't stand him, and I tried to kick him out of the band every day. And then one fateful evening, on Martin Luther King Day, everyone else had gone to bed, and there the two of us sat on the couch in our living room, and we were watching a Martin Luther King TV special on NPT, Nashville Public Television. But all of a sudden, out of nowhere, he blurted out, "Hot damn Martin Luther King, goddamn N-word communist. If I'd have had the chance, I'd have shot him myself." And I was shocked. I couldn't believe what I'd just heard. I couldn't believe that those words came out of the mouth of the man just sitting next to me on the couch in my house, in my living room. And I turned and I said to him, "You SOB." And he said, "What did you just say?" And I repeated myself, and he proceeded to tell me that if I said that again, that he would punch me in the face. And I thought, no, certainly not. So I repeated myself one more time, and sure enough, his fist hit my jaw. And I saw stars. And when I came to, I looked back over, and there he was, still fuming on the couch. And he told me that if I said it again, that he would again punch me in the face. And I thought, no. Certainly not. So I repeated myself one more time, and sure enough, once again, his fist hit my face. So it became apparent to me that this was going to be the game that we were playing, and I thought it so absurd. And my face was already numb enough to take another punch, so I said it again. Another fist right upside the head. Well, I proceeded to repeat myself at least 15, maybe 20 more times that evening. And sure enough, the next morning, he was finally kicked out of the band. I still love the South. I love the banjos and the fiddles and the memories of living in that little cabin right on the edge of Beach Creek and the Jack guys and the people in Sugar Grove and the corn liquor and the whimsy diddles and the flipper dingers and the bull roarers. And of course, most of all, the music. But there's this other thing that still lives there that I do not love. And I'd never realized how alive it was until that fateful evening on Martin Luther King Day. So fast forward nearly 20 years, and I was flying home to Los Angeles. And there in the terminal on the TV screen, the news was on, and I saw skinheads marching through the streets of Charlottesville, Virginia, carrying picket signs and torches, and it just looked to me like everything was on fire. And it was no longer just there on my living room couch. It was on the TV for the whole world to see. So I flew home, and I walked in my front door, and I looked at my bookshelf, and I pulled off this little book of poems called The Black Poets. It was a collection of poems from around the 1860s to about the 1960s. And I just opened it up to a random page, and landed on this beautiful poem written by a man named Sterling A. Brown. It was called Slim Greer Goes to Hell. And I read through this poem, this beautiful little story about a black man named Slim who dies and goes to heaven, but St. Peter won't quite let him in yet. And it moved me, and I rearranged the words just a little bit and put it to this melody that I'd had kicking around in my head, and I changed the name to Slim and the Devil.
Slim Greer went to heaven, St. Peter said. Been a good right boy, Slim, but now you's dead. Been a traveling rascal in your day. You can roam once more than you come to stay. Put these wings on your shoulders and save your feet. Slim spoke up and said, thank you, Pete. Then Peter said, go to hell and see all that they do and tell it back to me. But be sure to remember how everything goes. Slim said, I'll see you on the late watch boat. So we got to cavortin', swell as you choose. Like Lindy in the spirit of the St. Louis Blues. Well, he flew and he flew till at last he hit a hangar with the sign reading, this is it. So he parked his wings and he strolled around, getting used to his feet back on solid ground. Then he come to a mansion and walked right in. Up looked the devil with a sickly grin. No, I didn't think to look for you, Mr. Greer. Tell me, how could it be that you come by here? Said I just dropped by for a little spell. Make yourself at home, here's the keys to hell. Said the devil to Slim, let's go downtown. Took the devil's hand and he showed him around. Showed him body houses and cabarets. Made him think of New Orleans and Memphis days. Showed him folks all fighting round the roulette wheel, like Rampart Street in the south of Beale. Then he took him round the corner where Slim did see a preacher with a woman sitting on each knee. Showed him whiskey stills going everywhere, with a parcel of devils stretched dead drunk there. Then he took him to a furnace that some devils was firing. Hot as hell, Slim's a mean perspiring. White devils with pitchforks threw black devils on. Slim thought he'd better get moving along. Said Slim, this makes me think of home. Vicksburg, Little Rock, Jackson, and Rome. Then the devil gave Slim the big ha-ha. Turned into a cracker with the sheriff's star. So he ran for his wings, lit out from the ground. Hauled it back to Peter, he was heaven bound. Said Peter to Slim, man, you got back quick. Tell me, how's the devil, what's his latest trick? Oh no, said Slim, I can't really tell. That place was Dixie that I took for hell.
David Garza is a poet, visual artist, instrumentalist of all sorts, singer, producer, and a prolific songwriter from just outside of Dallas in the town of Irving, Texas. He built his following in the 1980s by self-promoting and self-releasing his music on cassette tape. After one title would sell out, he'd take those earnings and use it to make another one. And this was his business model for many years. His style is a blend of Latin folk, funk, blues, hip-hop, and singer-songwriter. Here's what David Garza's been up to in the last year. Lost Rhyme Acoustic Sketches, a collection of 100 songs, released. The chapbook, Critical Essay, Volume 1. And he co-produced Fiona Apple's new album, Fetch the Bolt Cutters, which has received countless rave reviews. David is a true independent artist. He's found his own way in the arts, he's done his own thing, and he continues to make his own mark. When he travels to gigs, he drives himself, he books his own tours, he creates his own tour posters. He's highly regarded and deeply respected by fellow musicians and peers, and when you see him perform live, you never knew one individual could possess such talent. Singing, playing, and connecting to the audience in between songs. Just one other little quick announcement. You'll hear a siren in this next song. Not to worry, it's all by design.
Between Rocco and Big Star, I put a capo on the fifth fret, but I never sound checked in the capes. Oh, no folk sing a babe. Heavy banjo with a rusty high G under a sticker of Bill Monroe. I prefer my burner ballads to be passed down by Tupac or Dre. I'm an old folk singer, babe. No matchstick on a $500 hat, no Pilates or yoga mat. I'll never bend your ear or chew the fat. In Americana like that. Such a bummer. I've never done a session with Emmylou Harris's drummer. I've never been to Third Man or sip moonshine in Jack White's man cave. I'm no folk singer, babe. I'm no folk singer, dude. I don't raise pigs or goats. I've never wowed the crowd like Dan Byrne or Steve Poltz. I don't know a soul in Nashville who's ever known my first or last name. I'm no folk singer, babe. Don't chew on toothpicks or vape. I can't afford analog tape. Never cut a 45 or 78. see you, babe, and I can pretty much guarantee Ken Burns will never make a documentary on me. I don't stick and poke or tear up when I hear Amazing Grace. And most times I confuse towns with plays. I'm an old folk singer, babe. I'm an old folk singer, babe.
There's a new bloom on the rosebush. It wasn't there yesterday, but I swear I see it now. Petals from thorns, perfume from dirt. Wake up, baby. Come to the garden. I know you're tired and so sick of the world. This earth turning, this planet grinding. That moon and that sun. Orphans of a broken galaxy. A family forgotten. Dread fills thoughts, my thoughts listless, until this morning I saw something. It wasn't there yesterday. Come see for yourself. There's a new bloom on the rose bush.
Town. I was packing up my gear. We two-stepped around that Continental Club, and then she disappeared. Oh, wandering Rosa, oh, where you been? Tell me, my wandering Rosa, will I see you again? I asked the student stars in the old gypsy wind, they all say, my wandering Rosa is on the run. I was way down in Lake Atitla, waving her jazz cigarette like a magic wand to tell you. I kissed a thousand angels and I scared a million ghosts. Ain't no rain like Rosa, ain't nothing close. Oh, wandering Rosa, oh, where you been? Tell me, my wandering Rosa, will I see you again? I start to get silent in the old gypsy wind, they all say, my wandering Rosa is on the run again. East of Babylon, deep in downtown LA, where the freaks shriek till dawn. So all the day, I tell you, I swear I saw my brown skin girl probably 7th of May. Someday I'm gonna buy that lady a cloudy diamond ring. Oh, wandering Rosa, where you been? Tell me, my wandering Rosa, will I see you again? Ask the Skid Row rainbows in that old gypsy wind, they'll say, my wandering Rosa is on the run again.
We'd like to take a moment now and thank our sponsor, Hugo's Family Marketplace. Groceries, bakery, deli, floral, you name it. Hugo's, local and family-owned, serving 10 locations in North Dakota and Minnesota since 1939.
Songwriter, guitarist, performer, and Toad the Wet Sprocket founding member Glenn Phillips appeared on last month's episode of the Great American Folk Show. If you missed it, and you really want to hear it, well, don't fret. All you got to do is visit the Great American Folk Show page on prairiepublic.org. You'll find every episode so far right there waiting for you to press play. Glenn was dynamite last month, and he's dynamite this month. What a real treat it is to welcome him back. Here he is reading the short story, Buck and the Buccaneer.
Everyone in my family either played an instrument or was a good singer. We were all musical, as we used to say back then. Every evening, after supper, my mother would sit down at the piano and play, and my dad would stand behind her and sing. Pop liked the music of the Mills Brothers, like Someday You'll Want Me to Want You, and Eddie Arnold, such as Any Time. Mom liked hymns, such as The Old Rugged Cross. Pop had a beautiful tenor voice. He'd try to get my brother and me to sing with him. And sometimes we did, but we didn't like to. It seemed sissy-ish. My dad wanted my brother John and me to learn to play the piano. John took to the piano like a duck to water, but I wasn't good at it and wanted to quit. Pop pointed out to me that all the girls would gather around whenever a man sat down at the piano. That wasn't incentive enough for me, though. I made a deal with my dad that I'd join the school band and learn to play an instrument if I could quit piano lessons. He finally gave in to me. I started out on the trombone. I had lots of fun with that, especially when I put a boxing glove on the end of the slide part. But there were enough trombones in the band already, so the band leader asked me to switch to the sousaphone. That's the big brass horn that you wrap around your neck and shoulders. I had even more fun with that. I got really good at imitating low-pitched human body sounds. All the kids in school thought that was funny. I also liked to sneak up on our pet cat and blast away. The first time I did that, the cat ran out the door and didn't come home for 5 days. Sousaphone players are seldom featured in band performances, but at one time, at a band contest, the band teacher had us play the Look Sharp March, which had a good bass part. I thought it sounded pretty good, but the judges didn't. In their comments afterwards, they said the bass player was way too loud. Ouch. The music in our family all started with my grandfather, Hubert, who everyone called by his nickname, Buck. Even his grandchildren called him Buck. Grandpa Buck lost his hair at a young age, but came up with a unique side comb, somewhat similar to President Trump's. Buck learned to be a barber, but his main interest was music. He was a good singer, and somehow he learned to play the violin and the guitar. I'm pretty sure he was self-taught on both. His violin sounded pretty squeaky sometimes, maybe because he was so hard of hearing. And I think he only knew about 4 chords on the guitar, although he could make any song conform to those 4 chords. But Buck was a good showman, and that counted for a lot. Grandpa Buck made sure his kids were musical, too. My dad, Dean, took up the clarinet, his brother, Pete, played the saxophone, and his sister, Phyllis, played the piano. Grandma Maud learned to play the drums, and just like that, they had an orchestra. They called themselves Buck and the Buccaneers. We have some scratchy old wire recordings of the band from the 1950s, and they sounded pretty good. They made good money playing for dances, too. I have a handbill from one of their shows in 1939. They took in $114.11 in receipts. By the time they paid off all their expenses, which included $3 for police, they pocketed $53.32. My dad was 18 then, Phyllis was 19, Pete was 20, and Buck and Maud were both 38 years old. Phyllis got married and moved away after World War II. Buck's brother-in-law, Harry, stepped in and played the piano for a few years. When Harry retired in 1957, my brother, John, took over on the piano. John was 12 at the time, but he was the best piano player the band had ever had. He played every weekend until he went off to college in 1963. The band stopped playing dance dates about then, but they'd still have practice sessions whenever the family got together. The Buccaneers played for dances all around the area, but most of their shows took place on Saturday nights in our town's city hall. There were lots of people in town on Saturday nights. They'd come in from their farms and from surrounding communities. The stores would be open, and people did a lot of their shopping then. Businesses would contribute items for an auction, which was conducted by a local guy named Jens Nelson. Jens could make everyone laugh, especially when he auctioned off items like toilet paper. In those days, there was no TV, so some families would go to the movies at the Star Theater. Tickets were 15 cents for adults and 10 cents for children. You could get popcorn and Coke at the concession stand. But Saturday nights were mostly for people who just wanted to gather and catch up and have some fun. There was a lot of social drinking and smoking going on back then. Some folks would start out at the bars, and by 9 o'clock, some of them would be pretty well lit. That's when the music would start at the city hall, and by 10 o'clock, the hall would be packed with people, and there'd be a big crowd of younger folks outside. Some of the people inside would be dancing, but most just stood on the sidelines and watched. There was lots of laughing and loud talk, as there always seems to be once the music starts. Kids weren't supposed to be allowed at the dances, but my brother and I knew a way to sneak in. We felt entitled, too, since it was our family who were performing. In the late 50s, there was a dance called the Limbo, where people would bend backwards and try to shuffle under a broomstick while keeping time with the music. No sober person would think of trying the Limbo, but by 11 o'clock in the evening, folks were lining up to give it a try. Lots of them ended up on their keisters while doing the Limbo, but I don't recall anyone getting hurt. It was uproariously funny. Even though the music went on until at least 1 a.m., most of the revelers would still make it to church on Sunday morning. One time our priest commented to my dad that he could count on a full collection plate the morning after a dance. In fact, I remember seeing the priest himself at the dances sometimes. Catholic priests were allowed to do things like that, but not the Methodist and Lutheran ministers. Grandma Maud died suddenly one Christmas Eve. I remember after her funeral, we all gathered at my parents' place. Buck was feeling pretty bad that day, but he asked everyone to get out their instruments for a practice session. The first song they played was Somebody Stole My Gal. The music went on for a couple of hours, and afterwards everyone felt a little better, especially Buck. But with their drummer gone, that was the end of Buck and the Buccaneers. A year or two later, people started asking Grandpa Buck if he thought he'd get married again. I remember one exchange where he said he would if he found the right woman. When he was pressed to say what kind of woman he would be interested in, he said he was looking for an older woman with lots of money and a bad cough. I never played the sousaphone again after high school, but my brother still plays the piano, and even now, whenever he sits down to play, all the ladies gather around him. My dad was right about the piano. I should have kept up with it. But then, Pop was right about most things.
I don't really know when I met our next guest, Tomo Nakayama, but I feel like I've known him for a long time. When I first started going up to Seattle, Washington, to play music in the early 2000s, a lot of people came up to me to ask me if I had heard of his band, Grand Hallway. We ended up playing a show together in 2015, me and Tomo, in Seattle, at the Columbia City Theater, really a great venue for live music, and we've since become good buddies and done lots of touring together. Tomo is a singer, songwriter, an instrumentalist, a producer. In April of this year, 2020, he released a brand new album, a dance album, on Porchlight Records, called Melon Day, which KEXP Radio reviewed as bright and beautiful. Tomo Nakayama joins us now.
Hi, Tom. It's so great to be with you again via the magic of the radio. The last time I saw you in person, we played a few shows together in the Pacific Northwest. You'll remember on that trip I brought along a Japanese singer, a fellow by the name of Ono Yuki. Well, I wanted to talk a bit today about my strange and fortuitous friendship with him. I first discovered his music about 10 years ago when I was on tour in Japan. Now, to give you a little background, I was born in Japan and immigrated to Seattle, Washington when I was 8 years old. It's here in Seattle I grew up and obtained my U.S. citizenship and learned to play guitar, and it's where I still live to this day. So there I was on tour some 20 years later, playing at a small basement venue in Tokyo. Between sets, the owner of the venue was playing this music over the PA system. Something about the song sounded so familiar, so comforting. Something about the singer's voice reminded me of home. I asked the owner who the artist was, and he handed me Ono Yuki's CD. I took it back to Seattle and listened to it everywhere, in my car, at work, even at my wedding. And a few years later, we actually had a chance to tour together and meet in person. Well, let me tell you, it was like looking into a mirror. He was about the same age as me, same height, build, similar hair and countenance. We hit it off right away, and as we talked, we realized we grew up listening to a lot of the same American rock and folk music, and started writing songs and playing in bands around the same age. And most amazingly, we learned that we were both born in the same island prefecture of Kochi, way out in the country, some 8 hours by train outside of Tokyo, and over 8,000 miles away from Seattle. We learned that our parents even attended neighboring schools and had a few mutual acquaintances dating back to the 1970s. So here I was, as an adult, returning to my homeland, face to face with an alternate universe version of myself, the person I might have been had I stayed and grown up in Japan. And we just happened to find each other across continents, all because I heard a song that reminded me of home. Isn't that something? I guess that's the power of music. Something deep and unconscious that reveals our origins without even realizing it. Well, that's my story, and I hope you're doing well, Tom. I look forward to the day we can all play music together again.
of train. I'm a place in mind. When I lose myself between two worlds, I find that I think of you, and I know it's true. There's a rabbit love.
stretch out and wave. See how our bodies sway. Some days I do regret. Some days I just forget.
The Great American Folk Show would like to thank David Garza, Bonnie Larson Steiger, Willie Watson, Glenn Phillips, and Tomo Nakayama. Opening theme by Sean Watkins in Los Angeles, California. End theme by Berkham Boys in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Our sponsor, Hugo's Family Marketplace. The Great American Folk Show was written and recorded by Tom Brousseau, produced and edited by Eric Detheridge and Bill Thomas. I'm Joe Wiegand. May you always find the sun until we meet again.
For more information about this program, please visit prairiepublic.org. On the next episode of The Great American Folk Show, poets Gino Sky and Bridget Bianca, singer-songwriters Chuck Suki and Suzanne Valley. Plus, we'll visit with folk artist Angelina Elise and more notes from the Badlands by Joe Wiegand. We'll see you then.